On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Michael Cianciosi. Michael is a seasoned sports scientist whose career spans both Australia and the United States. Michael shares his journey through prominent roles with the Carlton Football Club, Catapult Sports, Boston Red Sox, and most recently as the manager of Athlete Management Systems, Australian Institute of Sport, offering a unique perspective on the global evolution of sports science. Whether you're an athlete, coach, or sports science enthusiast, this episode is packed with practical insights and forward-thinking strategies for performance optimization in today's high-tech world. Now, on to the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. I have Michael Cianciosi, sports scientist, who's located in Australia. Michael, I had met, it's been probably a few years now. He was a professor of mine when I was doing my master's of applied sports science analytics at LaSalle University, and he actually taught a class that I was taking. So I had a chance to meet with Michael, and I figured this would be a great way to get some more information out to our peers about sports science, maybe some of the experiences that Michael has had and what he really focused on working with the teams that he worked with and the organizations he's worked with in the past, and then also get some information out to our listeners who maybe more want to understand more about how to use it for their benefit working with a sports scientist. Michael, thanks. I appreciate it. I know we were trying to get together here for the last couple of days and our time zones and days got all mixed up, but we figured it out. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for having me, Andrew. I was telling you, I did it full time for a few years working across the US and Australian time zones. And then I must have forgotten those skills because it took us a lot longer than it should have to work out what time and where we were meeting.
Yeah, it is a little challenging, but we got it together. So it's great. Can you give the listeners a little bit more background about yourself other than what I just kind of gave them as a brief, like little synopsis about you and why you kind of got involved in sports science?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think you did a good job of outlining my experience, probably just some stuff to add. Born and raised in Melbourne, Australia, which is now where I reside again. Was able to do some study while working at Carlton Footy Club. So I was really lucky early on in my career while studying, was working for a professional Australian rules football team and actually got to do some research for my honours during that time at Carlton. So a lot of the people I work with and met there kind of really shaped my opinion and thoughts on sports science. I got to work with Associate Professor Aaron Coutts, Johan Bilsbrough, Joel Hocking, Courtney Sullivan, some really good people there. And that's definitely a lot of where my sports science philosophy has come from, is those people who definitely shaped the journey. Made the jump into Catapult Sports, which was a sports tech company, as you outlined. And that was actually really cool and beneficial job because when you're working for one team, you know what you do, you know maybe what some other sports are doing, but you don't really get exposure to what a lot of people are doing. You're very much isolated or a little bit insulated. So working at Catapult, I worked across God knows how many sports, across a few different continents, and got to see a lot of programs with a brief snapshot and got some ideas of, I guess, what's been happening or what's happening across these organizations. Didn't think I would jump back into Teamland. I really enjoyed the corporate side of Catapult. But then through some connections, got offered a job at the Red Sox, which was too good to give up. And it's just such an amazing opportunity with sports science being quite a young discipline in the US. The Red Sox didn't have they had bits and pieces of a sports science program, but nothing kind of fully comprehensive and integrated. So the opportunity to build that program from the ground up with such a prestigious organization was, yeah, definitely too good to give up. So that was really cool. Probably a highlight of my career to this point, being a part of that team, being part of a World Series winning Red Sox in my first year, which probably didn't appreciate at the time how monumental that was. But now I definitely understand how huge that is. And then family kind of came calling and looking for a little bit more stability. I was traveling quite a bit between Australia and America. So decided to come back home and look for a little bit more of a 9-to-5 job and plan to start a young family, and was able to get a job with the Australian Institute of Sport, which is obviously really well known and has done some amazing work and is doing some amazing work. So been here for a few years now and kind of landed in the middle of an Olympic cycle, which I didn't really know what meant at the time, but everything was very much set and going at that point. Obviously with the Paris Olympics just finishing and the beginning of a new cycle leading into LA, There's a lot more innovation and setting up of processes and things. So really excited to be part of this program, at least for the next 4 years, to see our Olympics and see kind of how it looks from start to finish rather than just coming in kind of halfway through. Yeah, a little bit about me. I guess probably also mention doing my PhD at the moment with a bit of a biomechanics lens, using some Red Sox data, which I was lucky to get access to. And yeah, looking to solve, I guess, some movement variability problems.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, good description of kind of where you've been and where you are now. Can you give a little bit more information on what's on the Australian Institute of Sport? What's kind of their mission? What do they do, you know, on the sports science side? I mean, we can talk about, we know what the Boston Red Sox, who they are as an organization, and know Catapult is, and we know who the Australian Football Club is, right? What does the Institute do, and how does that apply to what you do as a professional, like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it's effectively an arm of the Australian government. So we're technically the Australian Sports Commission, which looks after everything related to sport, from funding, volunteers, all the way through to high-performance sport. The sports that we focus on is those that predominantly not professional. So Australian rules football, soccer, rugby, these sports, they kind of govern themselves for the most part with some input from the Sports Commission or the AIS. We're very much looking after Olympic sports. So these sports are a big part of their funding comes from the government. The AIS itself was set up, geez, I should know this, was set up in the 50s or 60s after, no, maybe not even that late. Don't quote me on the date, but was set up following, I think, one of Australia's worst kind of medal hauls. And the government was, yeah, unhappy with how things were going and was looking for a way to kind of really innovate and see if Australia could become a good performer again. So they built the facility in Canberra, which still stands today, and poured a whole heap of money and resources into trying to make Australia better at competing. And some of the stuff that came through in those early years and still through today is amazing. So it's a performance support servicing facility. It's a research hub. Basically a large high performance center for Australian Olympic sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost kind of similar, I guess, to what the U.S. has out in Colorado Springs for a lot of the athletes, I'm assuming. So, you get to still delve into the athlete side of it, right? So you're dealing with athletes that are coming through, with Australian athletes, and trying to, you know, work on performance and get them to the level that they need to be at to be competitive, to beat the people that they're, you know, competing against around the world, world championships, I'm assuming, and Olympic, correct?
Yeah, yeah. The nature of my role is probably a little bit removed from the coalface of sport from where I've been previously. So we actually service the NSOs, National Sporting Organizations. So we work with the staff in the sports who are looking to implement processes. So we're effectively a consultant for the Australian Institute of Sport, supporting these sporting organizations at trying to implement high performance strategies.
Now, what, as far as sports science goes, what kind of drove you into the profession? Was it, you know, a lot of us, we were, you know, athletes and moved into, you know, athlete training or into physical therapy, or even wanted to add an arm to our professional career by adding another, you know, professional degree to help us be better at what we do. What was it about sports science that kind of made you say, hey, this is something that I want to do for the rest of my life or work on to help athletes?
Yeah, I think my story is probably similar. A lover of sport, lover of all sport. I've always had an appetite to watch anything. And being in Australia, to watch a lot of sport, you need to wake up at obscure hours in the morning. And that's something that throughout my childhood, throughout my life, I've always been a huge fan of. I'd like to say I had a huge elaborate plan to get into sports science, and I saw the writing on the wall that it was going to be a big and up and coming area. But to be perfectly honest, it was very much luck. Like, I fell into a course. I was obviously interested in sport. I thought there might have been something there. Fell into a course, and again, was really lucky early on in finding some work through a friend of mine within an Australian football team, and then really quickly understood what was trying to happen. And also really realized pretty early that it was early in the piece and there was a lot of work to be done in this space. So, yeah, I guess really in a nutshell, I would say I got lucky and found a profession that was probably just starting out and got to kind of ride the wave or be part of that kind of, I wouldn't say the early movement, but was part of, you know, the earlier stages of it in Australian rules football, which is one of the, I guess, starting.
Yeah. Now, how did sports science evolve? Like, where did it start? Where did it come from? Just for the listeners' sake, to understand, like, what is it? You could say sports science or sports scientist, but what is that defined as a profession? Like, what? How does that encompass what we do?
I think it probably just evolved naturally over time. You know, the science of sport, there's been research prior to there was an official sports science degree or course, you know, human movement and physiology. These things have been studied for a lot longer than there was officially sports science. I think it's really been an evolution. Probably talking to the Australian experience, like the Australian Institute of Sport, the organization I'm working for at the moment, really was the trailblazer of sports science. And obviously, with so much government money, the processes and things they were looking to implement needed to be evidence-based and follow a process for the government to, I guess, put their money and things behind it. So, yeah, really, in essence, the science of sport, it's studying whether it's injury, whether it's physical performance. There's so many branches and arms of it now, but it's an evidence-based approach to helping athletes in so many different areas. I think we'll probably talk about it a little bit later as we go through this, but I think it's something really important to understand. I do feel as though we're at somewhat of a crossroads, you know, kind of remembering that the evidence-based approach is the cornerstone of sports science. It's easy to collect numbers now. There's lots of data. There's a lot of technology everywhere. Mm-hmm. Just because you're implementing this stuff doesn't mean you're necessarily doing sports science, because you need to make sure you're following that evidence-based approach. So that's something I'm really passionate about. And as it grows fast, it's important that it's sustainable growth and it's following kind of due process.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about evidence-based practice all the time in our clinical practice with physical therapy and athletic training. So we always are evolving and trying to get better at our practice. And, you know, in the same with sports science, right? We're trying, like you said, we're looking at the research. We're taking that research, we're making sure that we're doing the right thing for the people we're caring for or working with, so we can then provide the best for them. It's not just like, oh, I'm just going to slap a wearable on you and then read the data. And oh, this is actually working because we're showing performance improvements, and not really basing that off of the practice of evidence-based research. So you kind of, I think, hit the nail on the head. It's got to be research-based. It's got to be things that we're trying to look forward and trying to improve over our practice. You know, it could be day over day, right? So I think for us, we have to make sure that we're staying up with the current research and making sure that we're doing our own research to make sure that we're doing the right thing for the people that we're caring for. So when you look back to your, you know, earlier in your career when you were at Catapult, you know, as we, you know, talk about wearable technology or pressure plates or force plates, you see these all across weight rooms across the world, and people are using these to see performance based, get data, get analytics to be able to show what that athlete is doing to make that athlete better, to reduce injury, to increase performance, to make sure that we're doing the right thing to prevent injury, and working with the total medical team to make this happen. When you were a Catapult, that was kind of back in the early days, I think, of what this technology is right now. Can you explain what that was like working for them and some of the responsibilities you've had there, and how you carried that maybe on to your career over at the Red Sox?
Yeah, I think it was a really cool time to be part of that company. I think I had started, it was definitely still a startup, but it was kind of a small to medium-sized company, I feel, at that point, just about to explode into a large company. So I think they had gone public on the Australian Stock Exchange maybe a few months before I began. And I really got to see the explosion, the Catapult explosion at the time. And being around, the head office was based in Melbourne, the CEO and founders were based in Melbourne, and all of the development, being around that environment was really cool, just to see how they were trying to push the needle. And a lot of people, including myself, you kind of just had to wear a lot of different hats and get exposed to a lot of different things. So we did everything from obviously customer support, so making sure people were using the system and were getting what they needed from it. Pre-sale support, so going out and trying to help the sales guys attract in new customers. And then also helping, you know, with a little bit of R&D, whether it was how the software functioned and how that was able to be used by customers, or how the hardware was using, how it was performing with, you know, in terms of validity and reliability. I think probably the biggest, and I had mentioned it earlier, the biggest piece of that experience that shaped me was just seeing, you know, still quite young in my career at that point, had worked for one AFL team, seeing so many sports and customers in a short period of time really, really helped to shape my opinion of the industry. And I think it just kind of galvanized my thoughts that there's a lot of, you know, from Catapult itself, there's a lot of data and a lot of fields and metrics that come out of that system. But you notice like a lot of people are just using the same stuff, and the stuff that they're really using day to day is like really simple and basic things, but they're using it really well. So they're understanding it as well as they can, and they're looking to it, you know, making sure they're diving kind of headfirst into those basic metrics, total distance, high speed running, max speed, these things that are just tangible, and focusing on that rather than getting caught up on 1500 metrics coming out of that system. So, you know, people call them different things and the different fields, but I just really noticed that it was predominantly using the same stuff. So again, strengthen my opinion of like less is more, and still something I kind of believe in to this day.
How did that translate over to professional baseball? I mean, I know that it's got to be difficult for an organization that doesn't really have a strong background in sports science, right? And it's kind of new. And like you said, in the US, it was very, very new. And then, you know, you're trying to increase performance with athletes and reduce injury and trying to have predictability of these things. So your million-dollar, multi-million-dollar athletes stay on the field. Are you using that for all the above? Are you using it for performance? Are you trying to use something for working with the medical team? Is it something that you can predict and improve bat speed? Can you improve, you know, your time from home plate to first base and try to get that to become faster for that athlete? How did you translate that? I mean, you may not have used Catapult, but did you use something similar, or was it something like you said earlier was simple is more or less is more? Right. What did you try to focus on to make them understand that this is an important thing to have in the organization?
Yeah. No, we did use it. And unfortunately, I probably didn't get to see the project completely to the end and where I would have liked to have gotten it to. But probably just to talk a little bit about the start of that experience with the Red Sox, I think it's really worthwhile to share. So the way that the Red Sox really did set me up for success in that role, so obviously coming in, and there's a lot of people coming into these organizations that may not have had sports science previously. The Red Sox are very much sit and watch for a year. Take your time. Don't feel as though you need to make wholesale changes. We want to move slow and be considerate about what we do, which is great, because you could definitely feel, even with them saying that, there was pressures from other people. You know, what's this guy doing? Why is he around? Like, why do we need this? We're collecting data. We can work this out ourselves. But them kind of setting that precedent really allowed me to kind of step back and not be forced to make changes. And you definitely see examples of that, especially in American sport, where people come into these positions and are forced to make change. So with that as like a precedent, we were able to take our time and not feel rushed. And again, boring, but kind of really wanting to go for bang for buck things that we rolled out in the sports science department. So in saying that, our first version of rolling out Catapult was, you know, there's definitely some hesitation at the time, more so than probably now in Major League Baseball, for players to wear wearable technology. There was a bargaining agreement coming down the line with the union, and there was a lot of hesitation, fear about how data was going to be used. So we had to really pick our battles and take our time. So we wanted to use it, and we thought the best period was spring training. Like, can we get an understanding of what these guys are doing in practice? It's probably the only time of year we actually do get to practice, as well as what they do in games, to get a little bit of an understanding of games and see what we can learn and understand from that. And we really had to sell it to the players that we're going to use this from day one of spring training to the last day of spring training. And then after that, you no longer have to wear it. And this is to help you, you know, get you guys as prepared as possible. The players really bought into that, position players really bought into that. And we were able to roll that out and get some really cool information of just general like movement demands of a infielder, catcher, outfielder, and understand what they do. Like, everyone knows obviously catchers do less than infielders. Infielders probably do less than outfielders, but I'm kind of quantifying that and understanding could then give us some ideas of like, all right, how can we top these guys up? How can we make them fitter for their positional demands? How can we make them faster? How can we kind of support what they need? So we kind of rolled that out for a few years, specifically with Catapult, and major league players continued to buy into it. We're doing things like topping up players. You know, sometimes in spring training, players will just get pulled out early. And we started realizing like, oh, actually, we're not building you know, like a general kind of conditioning program. They're actually not increasing their load. Like they're doing all this practice at the start of spring training. They're going to games, but they're kind of just staying level, and we're not building their load, either total distance or high intensity running. So we started topping players up, which is kind of a new principle. Well, at the time, it wasn't something that was common, at least within our organization, and effectively just gave us more confidence for our position players that, you know, once the season starts, there's no such thing or very little days off, especially for those starting players. So it just gave us confidence that we're not going from, you know, a little bit more lackadaisy spring training games where they're not playing nine innings every day to they're going 6 or 7 days a week playing nine innings. We just knew that there was a smaller gap, and we were confident that we were putting our players in the best possible position to succeed. In terms of the pitching side, I think this is where there's some really cool stuff, and we probably didn't see it through, or I didn't get to see it through to its end, but we actually completed a validation study with La Trobe University here in Melbourne, and we were looking at a motion capture system, Vicon, and looking at how the catapult device performed next to that, as well as next to the motor sleeve. And what we saw from the catapult device was some really interesting stuff in regards to obviously not getting the same numbers. It's a device, it's an accelerometer compared to what you see with motion capture, but we're seeing the association in terms of what some of like proxies for intensity. We saw that we're really seeing the same trends. So when the motion capture stuff would appear to be higher intensity, we would see catapult following that trend. When it was lower, we'd see catapult following that trend. Whereas MODIS, there was a little bit more disagreement between the two systems. So what that told us is it's not gonna tell us how much stress is going in the elbow, how much stress is going in the shoulder. But what it's saying is like, okay, we've got a metric here that seems to be moving with the gold standard in Vicon. Let's use this as a tool to do what we're doing with the position players and get an understanding of, you know, over weeks, over months, how much load is going into these guys, and can we make some adjustments going into the season, coming out of rehab, where we understand where they're at, we know where they got to go, they got to throw 100 pitches, they got to pitch every other day as a reliever. Can we kind of bridge that gap and have an objective way to know we're competent?
So basically stress strain recovery, right? It's you're trying to monitor that through. Because we know, like you said, Major League Baseball, they might get 2 days off a month if they're lucky. I mean, it's like they're going. Exactly. And how do you build? They have to be able to, if you're creating stress and strain, you need recovery, but you also need to rebuild again. So how do you do that objectively? And how do you do that with, exactly, with the technology? And it seems like you guys were kind of you're getting to that and moving into that with using the devices that you have. Now, I spoke to, you know, a close friend of mine and peer Anthony Sarandolo, I think you know, is at the Red Sox. So Anthony and I were chatting, I don't know, several months ago, and they were talking about how they're trying to bring, you know, the guys wear Aura Ring, they may wear a Whoop, but they don't want to wear it at night, or they don't want to wear it out on the weekend, and because they don't want to know what's happening, right? So he said there's still a little bit of, you know, stuff that's happening where you can't get 100% buy-in, but I think if you have, you know, like you had mentioned, if we can, you as professionals can actually look at the data that you can look at the time that you can grab it. Like you said, less is more. So if you can figure that out, then, you know, the simple things seem like they're going to take care of themselves if you can get them to understand this is going to improve their performance. So I was always in that mindset of trying to provide enough information for the athlete that they understood what's better for them. So, you know, for instance, for high school athletes, they don't understand that they need to rest and recover. But how can we do that simplified in a way that they just get a little bit of information that they understand, like, hey, this is what we can do to improve our performance. But also, if I just sleep 7 or 8 hours a night, I'm going to get the recovery that I need instead of sleeping 5 hours a night. So if you can show them that research and that data, then they would at least start to see that if they started to do that without even having a device on. They probably can simply just, you know, they could do like a Likert scale type documentation on their own and be able to see that improvement over time. So it sounds like what you guys had started at the Red Sox is good. And it's going to keep improving as they keep, you know, getting better with understanding what that process is. So it'd be interesting to kind of see that research and see what came out of it.
Yeah, no, happy to share the validation stuff. I think it was pretty cool and definitely has some legs for utilization. But yeah, probably as well, just to make a, I'll get on my soapbox a lot about this, to make some points. So like you're talking about the high school students and parents who's listening to that stuff. I think you know, even at that consumer level, there's a lot of stuff being thrown at kids, especially talented kids and parents. Obviously, they want their kids to do the best, and there's other parents doing all these things. But I think it's probably stepping back and thinking, you know, a few basic things. Does my kid have a good training program? Like, have they got a program where they're gradually getting stronger, faster, whatever they need for the specific sport they're in is one. Like you said, are they recovering? Like, are they taking the time to sleep, to recover? And again, that's part of a training program. And then a diet. Those three things aren't kind of in check. There's no point getting a red light laser to try and improve, I don't know what, or there's no point trying to buy a wearable device if you haven't got a good program from a specialist. So I would say invest your time and effort in those big rocks. Focus on the things that really matter, because even the technology and stuff that we were implementing at the highest level, we're trying to get 0.1% more out of a professional baseballer who's already got so much. But having a training program for a high school kid, you can get 20% better. So your ability to improve is so much more. And focusing on that is really important. There's a time and a place for that other technology and those other processes, but do the big things really well and maximize your time and effort in those areas, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I talk about just get 1% better every day, right? So work on the foundation. You can't put the windows in a building if the foundation's not built, right? So I think if you're going out and buying all this stuff, it's not going to make a difference. You can't go and hop into a gym and start doing force plate training, you know, again, wear a wearable like Catapult and think you're going to improve if you don't have a good foundation and a good training ethic and you're not putting all that other stuff together. So that was a great point, and hopefully that's taken the right way from people that are listening. So how do you think the profession is actually changing, and where do you think it's going in terms of performance and working with the medical staffs on injury prevention and recovery?
I think it's an interesting one. I think, you know, the biggest push at the moment is more data, more technology and things like this. But I don't feel like the huge gains made in technology maybe 10, 15 years ago, I feel like the improvements are getting less and less. And it's more about what you're doing with it. So again, the way stuff's processed, you know, the way data's moved around now is so much better. There's so many different visualization tools. There's ways to use this information. So I think the practitioners are doing really well, aren't necessarily pulling in a whole heap of new technology, because the stuff that's there is really good and there'll always be improvements, but they're probably less gains, almost like that originally you get that 20% gain and then you start to see smaller and smaller. I think that's the same with the technology at the moment. It's really how the data is utilized day to day and how it's brought into the environment and made part of just the environment. I think athletes are exposed to it so much earlier, so you're actually able to get so much more benefit for the athletes because they understand it. It's part of their day-to-day, whereas not too long ago, you know, the most senior of athletes hadn't have seen it, or even the youngest of athletes in those organizations hadn't seen it. So that's important. I think to throw caution to the wind a little bit and to talk about, again, about my experiences, I think probably when I landed at the Red Sox, I was very much like, you know, the evidence is number one and, you know, whatever data we can collect, we should collect, and it's going to help us make better decisions. And that's what we want to do. We want to make better decisions so we can help our athletes better. But I think as well, like taking a step back and being aware that although you might be measuring a lot or you're measuring more than you have, there's a lot of things that we can't measure regardless of the technology and things that we have. So as things are exploding, it's easy to use data, easy to visualize data. I was really lucky. I got to live with some baseball coaches in my time, and that was during the COVID bubble kind of era. So we just sit at home talking and speaking more and more to these coaches. It became more and more obvious to me that if I'm going to be my data against the coach, I've got to be 100% certain that I'm measuring exactly everything that they're trying to understand or measure, because they've been watching baseball for 30 years and not just watching it as a spectator. These guys are locked in and there's so much that their eye is trained to see that, you know, the data we're collecting is only a small percentage of this. So I think the industry is going more and more data, more and more technology, but I think it's really important to still understand and focus that there's a lot of stuff that we're not measuring, and there's experts, and they're not experts because they're professors, they're experts of their sport, like lived experience for 30 plus years, I'd argue is greater than, you know, a couple of years in the system collecting data. So it's not to say that the data is useless, the technology is useless, but I think there really is a happy medium. And we didn't get there with the Red Sox of how do you build in a coach's eye and that lived experience of 30 years, you know, you want to talk about data, like their eyes, their brain is taking God knows how many inputs from their environments over the time, all these different athletes. How do we line that up with the data, with the things that we know from the data, and get the best possible understanding? And I think the organizations who are light years ahead of the others are those. They're the ones who understand what coaches know really well, and they're the ones who understand what the data can actually tell us, and they're the ones making decisions with the combination of the two. Because if you lean just on the data, and I've done it before, especially as a young person working in baseball, and when I say young to the sport, not having been around the sport, if you make that decisions just based on data, there's a lot of context that you're missing, and you can really trip over and land on your face.
Now, moving into that, like you said, like young, not having the experience there in that organization, how do you provide information to the stakeholders and the athletes to buy in? Like what type of, like if I think of visual analysis or data analysis and I look at like visual feedback, how do you get them to buy into what you're doing to say, hey, this is going to be beneficial? What are those things? So if you were moving into a new organization, how would you do that? And the Red Sox being one of them, what was the thing that kind of tripped them to the point of being like, yeah, this makes sense. This is going to make our team better, our athletes better.
Yeah, just I think basic information, colors, like obviously tailor to your audience. So there's people who want more. You should have the ability to provide those with more and the education to do so. Coaches probably want less than that. And then players want even less than that. So it's tailoring your pitch, right? You want a player to understand why they need to do this extra running after a spring training game. It's showing them like, hey, this is what you've got to do. This is what you're going to be doing every day in the regular season. This is what you're doing right now. You're going to be gassed when you get to the regular season if you've only done this in spring training. That makes sense. It passes a sniff test. Off they go. Showing that really simply. Same thing with coaches, you know. How is this going to help make their life better? All your outfielders are doing much less than they have previously. How do we close the gap? Pitchers, how do we show a slow and steady gradual increase for these guys to get them ready for what they've got to do in season? So, yeah, in terms of visualization, I just think colors, you know, words are probably better than numbers, and colors are probably better than words, like as simple as possible.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think people like flashy things, but if you start to throw too many, you know, I guess, pun intended, curveballs at them, they're gonna not buy into that and say, well, what's going on here? I just want to see, give me the nuts and bolts. That's what I want to see. And I think that probably gives them enough information. How do you think the future of sports science? I mean, we're looking at AI technology for a lot of things. We look at it for, you know, how are we going to use that to help us with documentation with patient care? How is it going to help us look for better ways to provide protocol production and things for our patients down the road? How do you think it is going to play into sports science and technology as far as improving what we do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think the important, I guess when I think of AI, and you know, there's always concern about it's going to take all our jobs and we're all going to be working for robots. I think the important part, I think, to understand about it is the most important piece of that process is still the human context, right? So, and thinking about that, how do I see, or how do I think that I'll be using in the future, is I think those monotonous tasks, those things that take a lot of time, like we should use AI to allow us to focus all of our attention on the most impactful pieces of our job, especially as sports scientists. Back in the day, we spent so much time in spreadsheets. Now we spend less time there. We spend more time in databases, in visualization tools. I would say, how can we use these tools to speed up those processes? You know, the processing, the data cleaning, these parts of the process, which are really important and super critical in doing a good job. But how can we spend more of our time at the decision-making side of things and less time in the monotonous day-to-day? There's places in the world or sports in the world where they use interns, and obviously that's great, but there's also human error in that. So I think AI is a lot less intimidating than people make it. I mean, if you position it as there still needs to be a human intervening or understanding the other contextual factors around it. So I think we're not as far as we think we are with AI. And I think, you know, I see it a lot in my current job. I'm around a lot of coders, but they've all got ChatGPT up there, and everyone's like, you know, ChatGPT is going to take our job. But it's almost just like a Google search, right? It's getting you the most important information as efficiently as possible to help you execute that task. Now, that might get less and less, but I think it's important to understand the human component will always be there to affect that final decision and context, however that looks, you know.
I think it's, it said best that you know, it's almost as if it's helping you tell the story you're trying to tell, right? So you're using it to the advantage of any other tool that you're using. Like if we're evaluating someone for a head injury, we're using a tool to help us evaluate, but then to provide the information that's needed to be able to make people understand this is why we're using this. It's knowing the person that we're evaluating, but the same thing with the technology. If you are trying to tell a story to, like you said, a coach, how are you going to use that to tell it in the way that they want to see so it doesn't look like it's foreign to them? So it's trying to help them in a way to visualize it. But the biggest thing is when I went through my applied sports science analytics degree, my thing was I really wanted to focus on sleep technology and sleep data for athletes because I knew that working with high school athletes for the past almost 30 years, sleep is crummy, they eat poorly, they're training way too much or doing more than one sport training during the year, and sometimes multiple sports a week just because they're trying to get ahead of the game and everybody else. I really wanted to focus on the sleep part of it because I knew if we can control their sleep, we knew that they could increase performance, we could reduce injury, more of the not the traumatic injury because that's going to happen, but more of the breakdown of their body injury. But also, I mean, think of the cognitive function side of it, right? If we're not getting 2 to 8.5 hours of sleep a night, which high school kids are rarely getting. But as the standard, we knew that we could at least control that. Now, that being said, without having a lot of money in a budget or someone, you know, being able to pick up the tab for something like a technology where your licensing fees per device are super expensive, you know, in the hundreds of dollars per person. What, as a sports scientist, what would you use if you were in that situation and you wanted to look at that type of data? What's this cheapest and easiest way that you could achieve that with that group to try to give them something tangible to say, hey, this is what we can do to see a change? What would that be?
Yeah, I think looking at sleep journals, right? Like an athlete's perception of how they slept, like, you know, it's not a perfect science, you know, Whoop and Oura Rings and these Garmin watches and things, they're also not a perfect science. So I think an athlete's perception of how they slept, as well as, you know, their idea of when they went to bed and when they woke up, is a pretty good, like anything again, and it's focusing on what trends are we seeing. And if it does nothing else, it gets the athlete to start thinking about it. You know, old sports science adage, just in general adage, I guess, science adage, if you can't measure it, you can't modify it. Like this, probably high school athletes out there that don't realize what they're doing, and then you start to focus a bit of attention on it, and it's kind of, I'm spending all this time training, like you said, multiple sports to try and get ahead of the game, but I'm playing PlayStation until midnight every night and I'm waking up at 6 because I got to get to training. Like, it's simple, like, don't worry about training, like, just go to bed 2 hours earlier. So I think that's the place to go. And Same old soapbox, but like these, you know, Whoop watches and things, they're great, but like, we know sleep quality isn't great from these devices. So what you're getting is only when they have fallen asleep and when they've woken up. So understanding that too, even if you had all the money in the world, there's still limitations with these things. So let's do the bang for buck stuff.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that explains a lot when it comes to, you really don't need all the bells and whistles, right? You got to start from ground zero and get an understanding for what it is that you need. And then once you understand the kind of the foundational piece of it by even, like you said, a simple sleep journal, that could be enough for you to understand. And then you can move into a technology base that'll be a little bit more finite and maybe break it down a little bit more for you so you can understand a little bit more deeply.
Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong, I look at my REM sleep from my Garmin watch and, you know, I look at my deep sleep, but I think it's, I also know when I look at it and it says, I haven't had any REM sleep for last week, I'm like, oh, that's probably not right, and I'm not going to freak out about that. So yeah, I guess empowering the athlete, knowing what the stuff can and can't do, and, you know, as long as they get into bed and they feel like they're falling asleep relatively quickly and they're waking up and feeling rested, like, that's the most important thing, right? Like, the data doesn't matter if they're feeling good and they're feeling better, which, if you help make some small sleep changes and they're going to feel better, that's better than any, you know, data trend you can show at the time.
Yeah, I was having some, you know, it going through that whole process of going back for another master's degree and working full time, my sleep was horrible. I mean, I might have been getting 4 hours a night of sleep, and that was kind of my trend for most of my career. I would do that, and then going back for the master's, it just kind of threw me over the edge. But I then got into, you know, using the Whoop device to see, let me see what my sleep really looks like, because I knew if I was going to bed later, I wasn't great getting up and I wasn't feeling great. Let me just see. I started to change the way my habits were because I was looking at the data. So it was opposite, because I knew enough about it, because going through the degree and understanding the data. For me, I could do it, but for a young athlete, I feel like that's very tough to do. But now I know that I can go to bed at 9 o'clock at night, wake up at 4:35 in the morning, and I have more than enough rest, and I can have a great day, and I can go through my entire day. I can get a workout in, and I don't feel like I'm exhausted at the end of the day. On the flip side, if I didn't do this, I'd probably still be trying to figure out like where my rhythm is. For me, as an adult, I was able to use it in that way. But I don't, like you, I don't always rely on it, because there are days where it shows that my deep sleep wasn't where I needed to be, or my REM sleep wasn't where I needed to be. But I do know that if I am not feeling good and I look at the data, it shows me that my recovery was horrible. So I know that, hey, something's up. And for that day or two, it definitely shows something if I'm getting sick. But I think it's a little too deep for someone that's trying to figure out performance level stuff, especially a high school kid. As far as anybody that might be interested in getting into, you know, the profession of sports science and is interested in it as a career, what would your advice be to them, and how should they pursue that?
I think probably now that, you know, I think we're only a few years away from sports scientists coming out of school needs to have like pretty good data management skills or data literacy, able to use programs, SQL, Python, these things. I think previously a sports scientist, you come out just with the strong knowledge and background of how to apply science to sport. I think now you also need to complement that with the data skills. So that's something that I'm still working on. And, you know, I've been working in sport for nearly 15 years, and my technical skills with data aren't exactly where I want them to be. So I think if I was lucky enough to be able to pause everything and go to school for a couple of years, I would definitely be spending some time and getting those data skills. So it just makes, you know, to that AI discussion of spending less time on those monotonous day-to-day tasks, like having those skills means you can spend more time applying the science than stuck in a database or a spreadsheet or a system somewhere. So that would be my number one piece of advice. And then I guess another piece of advice for those pursuing just sports, a difficult world, and just really, you know, there's not many jobs within cities, you know, if you want to go back and live in a specific city with your family. So just making sure that it's something you really want to do long term. You know, what you want to do when you're 26 is very different to what you want to do maybe when you're 36. I think the golden, the silver lining of sport and the excitement and the adrenaline, it's important to know, like, okay, this is something I want to do for a long time. And always think about, like, yeah, these data, you know, for example, the data skills, they might be able to get me a job in a profession outside of sport one day, which is potentially what I want to do. But I think it's important to step back and say, okay, do I want to work in sport forever? If you do, go ahead. But always know that, it is a tough industry.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I got into it, I wanted to add to what I was already doing as a professional. So for me, I felt like I've already achieved what I wanted to at the professional level of athlete training and physical therapy. And I said, what can get me to the next level of adding something more and me understand more about the evidence-based practice, but evidence-based research for the athletes that I'm caring for? And how can I then be almost like we can be a predictor of what's going to happen with them if we can provide some more information? So that's the reason I end up getting into it. And I figured I'm not going to always do what I'm doing for the rest of my life. So I could always have something else that I can get into that would help me with my expertise in the athletic training field. So do you ever see that the profession of athletic training or physical therapy would just have this as an adjunct to their profession? Do you think that is something in the future that might be coming down the road?
I think so. I think especially for those who are looking to move into the sport world, obviously there's those clinical versions where it's less, but obviously with athletic training, not so much. But 100%. These skills or these understanding these philosophies or how to use this information is super important. So no brainer for that to be provided and exposed to people going through those degrees sooner. So that when they get to a professional team and, you know, obviously they know their world really well, and then someone comes like, hey, this data says maybe we should do something slightly different, they're able to navigate that. And again, more information, more context to make a better decision. That's effectively what we want to be doing.
Yeah, 100%. I couldn't agree with you more with that. Any fun facts about yourself? What do you like to do outside of work?
This is probably the hardest question for me to answer, but what I landed on, I spent the most time thinking about this question. I think I spend a lot of time in front of a computer, and I've spent a lot of time inside in front of a computer. So the older and older I've gotten, the more and more I realize I'm trying to minimize my time in front of a computer. So whenever I can, I love getting outside. Probably a little bit too early in my life to be admitting this, but I love being in the garden. So Italian heritage, Italian background. We're in summer here, so I got tomatoes planted. And yeah, majority of the time, if I'm not inside working, I'll be out there watching the tomatoes grow.
Any olives or sunflowers or grapes?
Yeah. Oh, actually, I got sunflowers planted. I got some olive trees at the front, and my niece Ayla loves sunflowers. So every summer, I make sure I plant some.
True Italian, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
My wife wants to go over and she wants to visit Australia. We just got back from, we were in South Africa for a couple of weeks, which was amazing.
That's cool.
And we want to make a trip over to your neck of the woods. What's the tip of travel if we come that way?
I always say if you're going to come to Melbourne, it's a little bit cooler than you probably expect for Australia. So come in January. The best time I think to come to the city is Australian Open. I think that's when the weather's good. It's like a festival of sport. Make sure you spend a couple of weeks here. It's a lot of travel. We're used to going that way. I don't think many people are used to coming this way and traveling that far. So make sure you make the most of the time and how much it costs these days to get out here and spend a good couple of weeks.
Yeah. I'm a diver, so I'd want to go do a little dive when I'm up there too. So.
Oh, yeah. That would be cool.
Well, Michael, again, thanks for your time. I appreciate what you were able to provide today. I think the knowledge is fantastic. I hope the profession continues to grow. I hope we can continue to have these conversations, and I wish the best. And maybe someday the Red Sox will move you back to the United States and you can move the whole family over here to work.
See how that one goes. It's Andrew. Appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
See you, mate.
Thank you for tuning into the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we're committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find all of our episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also follow us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or check out our websites at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com and at ajrsportsscience.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science. Stay tuned for our next episode.